Welcome to this episode of the Essential Church Podcast, an ongoing conversation about some of the most important issues facing the local church. I'm your host, Andrew Arendt, and today I'm going to take you to a conversation that Daniel Grothy and I had recently with Ian Simpkins. Ian is a pastor at a church, the Bridge Church, out in Nashville, and is a most interesting fellow. He's got a background in music, grew up in Detroit, came and experienced his first pastor at a church that was in crisis years ago, and has so many wonderful things to say about the life of formation, the life of dwelling in the presence of God, what that means for pastoral ministry, how we pastor people in this cultural moment. It was really great to sit down with Ian and talk with him, and I think you're going to enjoy the conversation. So without further commentary from me, here's to the interview. Well, here we are today, Andrew Arendt. We've got Ian Simpkins here with us. And Ian, you're in Nashville right now on this call where you pastor the Bridge Church, and originally from Detroit. Mm-hmm. So you've been yelling at the TV the last many weeks, and you know, your city came back to life, and the football, and you're the oldest of seven kids, which I mm-hmm. understand you understood your role in the family to be the guinea pig of, you know, this homeschooling family, and you were the one who went out first. And so we'll get to some of that. You moved to Chicagoland for a time and then ended up in Nashville. You're married to Katie, and you've got three little boys, 6, 5, and 18 months. And mm-hmm. so you're in the thick of it. So, Ian, welcome to the Essential Church Podcast. We're thrilled to have you.
Man, thank you, brother. I'm honored to be here.
Yeah. So, getting to know you, I think it's helpful for our listeners to just right out of the gate. I was looking around your website recently, and you have a list of authors, thinkers, pastors, philosophers, writers, poets who have shaped you. So what I want to do just to get us started, you're a musician, you're a missionary, you're a pastor, you're a storyteller. I'm always interested in who has shaped a person. And so I'm going to give you a list of three names that you put on your website. You got a big list. I'm going to give you the first grouping of three. And I want to, you pick the one who you want to talk about and tell us why this person shaped you. So just give us a glimpse. The first list of three, Dorothy Day, Corrie Ten Boom, and Mother Teresa. Mm. Go.
Gosh, how do you pick just one, man? I spent a summer in India after undergrad, and I was supposed to be working with a pastor who, once I arrived, I sort of discovered, to put it kindly, was a bit of a shyster. Mm-hmm. And so he would lock me in his house and make me do his dishes and clean his car. I was supposed to be doing an internship, and so I would sneak out of the house and work with another ministry that I'd found down the block. And that really upset him, so he kicked me out of his house. So I lived as
homeless in India.
Wow. Honestly, for about 2.5 months by myself, some of the most terrifying but also enthralling formative months, honestly, maybe of my entire life. And and for some reason made my way to Calcutta for just a couple of days, and I got to actually like sit at her gravesite there in the Sisters of Charity building. Mm. and read about her life in the presence of the place that she ministered. Mm. And I was probably honestly reading some Shane Claiborne at the time, I think.
Yep.
Back in 2005, 2006. Mm-hmm. And that just left a really deep imprint on me. I had sort of been running from this call to ministry for probably half a decade, and my agreement with God was, all right, well, I'll do student ministry. That at least seems like where the most fun is. And to be shaped by some of these authors, even having just an incredible undergrad experience at Judson University outside Chicago, being shaped by Mother Teresa that summer, and then and then going into student ministry in the suburbs of Chicago was felt like whiplash, but in a pretty wild way. Those couple of months, I think, shaped and affected my trajectory in ministry more than I think I realized. Mother Teresa, you know, there's so many one-liners from her, but yeah. the notion of like there are no great acts, just small acts with great love.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember reading that thinking, That's the kind of pastor that I want. That's the kind of leader that I hope by God's grace I can become.
Okay, second list. Beautiful first answer. Second list. Henry Nouwen, Eugene Peterson, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel.
Who, by the way, I looked at this list this morning. Abraham Joshua Heschel appears on your list twice.
Yes, yes.
That's how much I like him.
As well as J.R.R. Tolkien. So I don't know if that's like subliminal, like, hey, just so you all know, I really like these
We've got
guys.
Our editor over here. Good Lord.
I feel like you're calling me out for my lack of proofreading.
I'm not calling you out. I loved it. I was like, he likes these guys a lot.
Nouwen, Peterson, Heschel, who do you got?
How much can I cheat at this? I mean,
take your liberties.
Peterson's the pastor changed my life, and continues to be honest. Nouwen, again, to give props to my undergrad, you know, I was studying student ministries and they were having us read Willard and Nouwen and Brother Lawrence.
That's awesome.
I just didn't realize what a gift that was.
Yeah.
Nouwen to this day has done some of, I think, the finest work on Christian leadership.
Yep.
You know, I was introduced Way of the Heart, and like a lot of people, but his reflections on Christian leadership.
In the name of Jesus. Yeah.
I have continued to come back to you. It's just been such a deep well. But the pastor, I that is required reading for any young pastor that I mentor now.
Yeah.
And Heschel, has anyone written more beautifully on the Sabbath?
Lord have mercy.
Yeah, that's a non-answer. I'm so sorry. There's just so many. Yeah. Such a funny. I feel like I want to ask follow-up questions. Why you grouped them that way?
Okay, so let me just kind of drill down one layer deeper and go to kind of the formative Ian Simpkins season. I'm interested in root memories that have marked a person. So, can you take us to a root memory for you? How did you become who you became?
Gosh, my first instinct is to answer my parents in a big way. You know, they pulled me out of school to do the homeschooling thing before it was cool, you know? So we were like social pariah number one. It was such an odd time and I was of course kicked off the track team and the soccer team, and you were not allowed to participate in, you know, the public school life anymore, which for an 11-year-old or 12-year-old is devastating. My father, this would be kind of a long-winded meandering trail, but my father loves to this day the band The Who, and Keith Moon in particular. And so my mom bought him a drum set, and he never learned to play. It just sat set up in our basement. And I remember one day, it was the year I was pulled out of school. I was just sort of in the backyard in a spiral of self-loathing. And we lived on a corner street, and a guy that I only sort of knew was walking past the house, and he yelled at me. It was like out of a 90s movie. Like, he's like, hey, are you the kid that plays drums? And I was like, I don't play drums, but I have a drum set. And he tosses me this cassette over the fence. And he said, learn track two. We're playing in the talent show next month. And it was Nirvana's Nevermind. My dad had a friend in the church that like taught me the basics of where to put your arms and playing drums. He taught me about, he said this line. He said, the difference between music and noise is rest. I've come back to that sentiment a number of times. He was trying to teach me about drums, but not realizing he was teaching me about so much more. And we played this talent show. We won this talent show, and so we started a band. And so I, in a lot of ways, found my community playing punk music and skating. And that's what we did. So that's the kind of core root memory number one. That was my anticipation. I'm just going to study music. I'm going to move to a coast somewhere, learn to surf, and be done with it. And then around that same time is when I was about 16 at this point, our pastor told me that he wanted me to preach next month. And I said, no, thank you. And he said, I wasn't asking you.
Yeah. Wow.
And there's a whole lot there as well. But I delivered a message. I called it Moses, the Reluctant Leader, not realizing how weirdly prophetic that would become in my life. And it was horrible. It was like just objectively a really bad. So I, you know, walk off the stage dejected and embarrassed. And this woman in our church, who at the time must have been in her late 80s, early 90s, she walked up to me, and what she really said, two things. She pointed back to the pulpit and she goes, that was bad. And I'm like, thank you. And then she said, she like looked into my soul, man. She's like, I believe the Lord has given you a voice, so you better learn how to actually use it.
Wow.
And then,
and that just shook me to my core. So these two things kind of happening simultaneously, finding this community in, yeah, in music, and then having this like strange word spoken over me from sort of this matriarch in our community. Yeah. Mm. And that's kind of where the wrestling match began for me.
Wow. Ian, thank you for sharing that. I'm kind of fascinated by you for a number of reasons. All of those folks that you mentioned who have helped form you. Then also there's just something about the ethos of your church that's really attractive to me. And I think if I was a person not in ministry living in Nashville, I would be like, I want to go to that church. It feels very human. It feels very real to me. And I love like the tagline of your church. I think it's your mission statement, how you guys talk about it. Be with Jesus, become like him for the sake of the world. Did I get that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Can you just take us into that definition? Maybe peel the layers of that back, pick those pieces apart, and just talk about why those things are important to you and how they're shaping your ministry, how they're shaping your church in Nashville.
Yeah. I thank you for saying that, man. I mean, first I have to admit, you know, there are people way before us, John Mark Comer probably most notably, articulating things in a similar fashion. So, you know, we can't claim any originality. The way that we kind of organize it is I'm a sucker for a good Venn diagram. So we talk about presence, formation, and mission. And it's been fun even with our staff to like articulate, hey, what happens when we have presence and formation but not mission, or presence and mission but not formation?
Yeah.
Identifying when you only have two of the three, we're kind of some of the deficiencies. And we, you know, in the Gospels when Jesus says, follow me and I will make you fishers of men, that's presence, formation. And that's kind of the distillation for us.
Yeah.
That Jesus always says, come to me before he says, go for me. Mm-hmm. And what I had discovered, and a lot of this kind of shows my own proclivity, I have a natural bent towards workaholism, doing good things often, I think even with good motives, but like following the applause or the, there's a lot of cheerleaders on the road to accomplishment and production. And I had no clue how to abide. I just didn't have a picture or a vision. I had no imagination for it. And I began looking at other church mission statements. This is no knock on any other church, but I realized how many of them began with the doing, the action.
Of course.
And they're often very good things. They're noteworthy and honorable. Yeah. I was like, man, no wonder we have such a burnout, unraveling, deconstruction problem as we begin first with doing, action, going. And I think in a lot of ways have lost some of the contemplative, what Jesus would maybe call the foundation of the house. And we just jump right to the construction of the house.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's cheesy, but I tend to picture like a tree. I think presence is the intimacy. That's the root system.
Yeah.
You know, the trunk is that's how we mature. We're formed and grow up in Christ.
Yep.
And then the branches are the reach. And so a tree that's all reach but no roots eventually topples over. But a tree that's all roots and no branches is not accomplishing what a tree was intended to do. So seeing those.
Yes.
And having patience for, in any given church, if it's more than three people, you'll have people that are more prone toward mission and more prone toward formation. So like trying to honor and give space to all of that too, but help people not only envision themselves in one of those, but like what would it look like for a more holistic vision of apprenticeship to Jesus?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I want to say, because I do think sometimes the ideal in the church is that like everybody is going to be all of these things in equal measure. Yes. And I just think that that's not right. Like I think that in the scriptures, I think you have Anna in the temple who never left the temple, fasting and praying day and night. I mean, that is a presence woman if ever there was. And then, of course, you got the Apostle Paul, who's a contemplative in his own way. But that dude is an Enneagram 3, you know what I mean, in anticipation of the 21st century. So we've got different people like that. But I'm really curious just to know, in Nashville, Tennessee, in 2024, which of those three things are you finding the greatest headwinds against in terms of our culture? So our culture is always setting us up in one way or another not to be faithful to Jesus. But I do think that there are ebbs and flows of culture. Mm-hmm. And there are certain aspects of any given culture that make some of those things more difficult. Where are you finding the most difficulty in your context?
Boy, that is a great question. I would probably say formation, to be honest. Now, that might be because I think that is my natural bent. I think you know, and Glenn Packiam has done a lot of great work here in articulating what happens when only one is articulated or emphasized, particularly in the Sunday morning expression. So I would highly commend, I'm sure you've read it, his Resilient Pastor work. But I think in Nashville, and even just the level of musicianship and excellence available in this region is just so foreign to me. I hesitate even letting people know I'm a drummer, because I'm like, I know I'm a Detroit drummer. That's different than you know. So some of the sort of presence I think Glenn would talk about as encounter, the encounter excellence bar is really high and pretty dialed in, and the missional piece, you know, those who are, you know, if you're a fivefold guy, the kind of wired more apostolic evangelist. I think formation in at least in this region is the hardest to make a case for because it's the hardest to pin down or quantify, you know, like if a great presence experience, you can kind of feel that in the room. And if you're making great missional strides, there's usually some kind of metric attached to that. Formation is so nebulous. And I think it's the ethereal nature of that makes
like
it sometimes
convincing,
hard.
Convincing people that they need to take the occasional solitude day or have a Sabbath. That doesn't take that much convincing because people know that they're overworked. And maybe like in an ambitious American culture, convincing people that we can do something for Jesus, the missional side.
Yes.
But what Eugene Peterson called the long obedience in the same direction, like the discipleship, that's what you're saying is the hardest part.
That's 100% right. It's a little cheese ball, but I will regularly say formation is way more crockpot than microwave.
Yep.
And that can feel really scandalizing in a highly microwave context where we want immediate results and I want to be able to point a board to metrics and that was a good investment and we're up and to the right and all of that. Formation kind of stands in a lot of ways against some of that, and that can be pretty unnerving, I think.
So what do you find yourself saying over and over again to your people that's actually helping you make – I'm serious. Like it's actually helping you make headway with them on embracing the life of discipleship.
There's probably – so we just – we had a woman interview for a position here, and she brought to the interview an Ian Sermon bingo card that she created. So I'm feeling like particularly vulnerable because it's like all these things that I say. It's including, you know, like he makes Nickelback jokes all the time or – he's always quoting Dallas Willard, but like that's definitely top of mind. I'm like, oh, I do say that a lot.
Yeah.
So I will have like, there's some kitschy one-liners that I think I probably come back to a lot. And I'll talk about activity is a terrible trade-off for intimacy, like really drawing people back to abiding and the chiseling difficult work of formation. But I think a lot of it actually comes down to choosing to be more vulnerable than I would otherwise want to be. Like helping give people a picture of vision. Just because I'm on a stage with a microphone does not mean I'm on the other side. I've arrived, and I'd like for you all to follow my pattern. I think the more that you share week in, week out in the long obedience in the same direction, people I think, and that's not for everybody. I'm certainly sympathetic to the temptation for anyone to want the person on a stage to have absolute airtight certainty about everything because my life feels so uncertain. So I need you to be superhuman. Yeah. And if you're not, then I can't trust you. I'm sympathetic to that. I'm just not interested in leading like that. So I think choosing to, and it's not my natural bent to be vulnerable or transparent. My natural bent is stoicism. Never let them see a sweat. I have the answer. And if I don't, I'll find it. I think that has probably been the single greatest, from what they tell me, invitation to a life of formation, because they recognize in me like, oh, we're actually not all that different.
Yeah.
Hey, Ian, in the pre-show chat, you told us about your first arrest. And it was beautiful. So I thought, in the spirit of vulnerability, in the spirit of not being the airtight pastor, and I think it's interesting that formation is the thing that you feel made for out of the three. You had some deformation that the Spirit had to kind of take you out of. Tell us about that. Maybe it was just a silly moment of rascality on a Saturday night, but tell us about that first arrest.
I mean, it was more than – you're very kind to give me an off-ramp like that, but it was more than just one, you know, I'm a family of nine. I had access to a 15 passenger van. So that
love where this story is going.
We would regularly, like one of the things we did a lot was we would steal construction barrels and we would close off freeway entrances. That's very illegal.
I think at the federal level, that's illegal. That's not just the state or local.
Yeah. You got yourself on a watch list.
Yeah, this could be problematic that this is now recorded in the public archives.
It's not problematic for us. It's problematic for you. Do say so. We can't edit.
The first one, though, I will say the first one was something that my parents knew I was doing. This is how cool my parents were. That a bunch of seniors had vandalized my car. And at least in our region in Detroit, when you graduate, you paint your car and you use washable paint, and it's a whole thing. They didn't want to do that with their car, so they did it on mine, but they didn't use washable paint. So I had all like profanities written on my car, and it was a bunch of seniors. And I asked my dad, I said, "Hey, their senior party is tonight. All their cars are going to be together in a parking lot. Can my brother and I, can we go and vandalize some of theirs?" And his words to me were, "Don't get caught." So we snuck in. So cool. We snuck in. We got caught. Got put in the back of a cop car. And we're driven home. And they rapped on the door. And my dad, this is classic dad. This is maybe TMI. But he answers the door, not wearing pants, because it's 5 p.m. And that's just...
that's right. This is Detroit, baby.
Exactly right. And this exactly, and this was like out of a movie scene, because the police officer goes, "Do you know where your sons were?" And my dad goes, "Yeah, I think they're up at the high school vandalizing some cars," and like it stopped him in his tracks. And my dad looked at the two of us and said, "I thought I told you not to get caught. Get in here."
You got in trouble because you got caught.
Yeah, that was the moral of the story. Yes,
wow. That's hilarious. This is a little rabbit trail, but we've got two out of three of us as drummers here on this podcast. So
yes, sir.
So let's talk just a little bit. You're a preacher. You're 40. I'm 41. Andrew, you 42, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. We're in the same stage of life. We all kind of stand up weekly, you know, got to get the word of the Lord for a people. And it's one thing to do one-off preaching and give your greatest hits, but it's another thing to lead the same people in a direction 52 mm-hmm. weeks a year for a decade plus. So I think drummers, I think musicians, I mean, this isn't a rule, but I've just got a working, you know, I've got a dog in this fight, but I think they can be some of the great preachers because drummers read a room. Drummers know the tempo, like what's the feel here? What BPM is this text? Mm. What key are we in this text? Is this a dark kind of minor chord dirge? Is this a 140? You know, like what is this text trying to do? So like the musicality that you've been raised in, how do you think it's helped your preaching?
I love this question. I think I overheard you and Mike Kelsey having this conversation a couple years ago, who's also
a great drummer
and a phenomenal preacher. I think I love what you just said. I don't think I would have answered that way. I think it honestly, it has a lot to do with cadence. Even writing has a rhythm to it. Mm-hmm. You know, we've probably all come across writing and are like, "Oh man, I like that principle. Mm-hmm. I don't like how it's written." Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's just a drummer thing or a music thing. Like, "Oh, I agree with your conclusion."
An aesthetic sensibility. There's
exactly.
That least,
that's like the least compelling way to write that. Or, "Oh man, if you lost just two of these words, that would have matched," or that would have. I also think there's a compositional component. Like I had a buddy, this guy was ahead of his time. We were, we're playing punk music, so not a lot of finesse in the drumming department there. But he would talk about our band as a collective whole. And I remember him saying, this is 25 years ago. He's like, "If we're all playing at 100% all the time, that's a wall of noise. We need to know whose moment is it right now. Is this Ian's moment? Mm-hmm. Is this Steve's moment for a solo? If we're all soloing, riffing, it doesn't translate to anything." And I think the compositional nature of, "Hey, the sermon is not the main event here. Like the worst, not the opening act, and communion isn't like some nice snack to follow." Like when you think compositionally, how do I fit in the pocket of what this gathering means and what it's meant to point us to and what is exactly what you're saying? What is the chord structure, but also maybe the key that this song needs to be in today? And I do think that preachers that are able to kind of think through that lens. And sometimes I'll bring this up and people look at me like I'm from a different planet. They're like, "You're thinking too much about this." I'm like, that's also very probable.
No, you are not. No, you are not. Andrew, what do you want to ask him about writing? because you just brought that up, composition, writing, and aesthetic sense. Ian, you've got all these little black boxes that you're writing up on Instagram, and you have a touch. I mean, it's working. Mm-hmm. So like Andrew and I are getting our doctorates right now in the sacred art of writing. What comes to your mind?
Well, I just to sharpen that up, maybe I love that instinct to ask that question. I think that some of the best preachers are usually really great writers. And I think that most of them have an ongoing conversation, whether they're writers first or preachers first. There's sort of that relationship is an interesting relationship. So how does the relationship work for you? And what would you say? Are you a writer first or a preacher first? Preacher first, writer first? How are those? What's the relationship between those two things for you?
Boy, I'm not trying to be kitschy. I don't think I would say either. I think I'm a storyteller first. Yeah. Hmm. That's the water I swam in. That's when I go home to my family. There is no need for an agenda. We just tell stories.
That's great.
And it's my favorite thing in the world. Mm-hmm. So I think that part's always been there. The preaching thing, I had to learn really early on, and maybe this is a normal journey, but I remember the first sermon I gave after undergrad, I invited a mentor of mine, and you know, if we talk for very long, you'll hear me mention mentors a lot. I am the product of some really faithful men that saw the train wreck before it happened to kind of steer and coach. So I invited him, you know, like a little puppy dog. I wanted to hear his feedback, and the room cleared out, and he just had his arms crossed, and he's like, "Have you been listening to a lot of this guy, and this guy?" Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Yeah," because that's all I could hear up there. And then he said, "This kind of changed my life." I was 21 or something. And he said, "If you don't believe that God has given you a voice for these people at this particular place and time, you have no business preaching." And that felt so harsh, but that was so helpful because I was just trying to mimic, like learning an instrument. I'm just trying to mimic the drummers that I love. And he's like, that's how you learn. But that is not ultimately how you need to graduate beyond that at some point. So for me, like the black boxes thing, I like fell accidentally into, man, with, you know, it was June of 2020. And after George Floyd and people were doing the black boxes, and there's, I understand that there's all sorts of different opinions on people that I just felt really burdened to do or say something. So I did the black box and I had a radio show at the time. And I told my co-host, I was like, I think we need to spend the next couple of weeks doing a lot more listening than talking. Mm. And so we just spent 2 weeks inviting men and women of color in our city, leaders and pastors and practitioners, just learning from. And at the end of that 2 weeks, I there was something that I felt like kind of distilled down. I was like, I wonder if this would be helpful. That's usually what it comes down to me. I don't feel the need to just keep chucking stuff into the ether. There's so many wiser, smarter people, but if I think it might be helpful. So I shared it, and it was just, you know, in my Apple notes, people ask about my aesthetic and I'm like, you're going to have to thank Steve Jobs for that. I don't know how to do anything better. And the response was, oh, that was helpful. Do you have any other thoughts on that? And that's kind of what got me started in, man, is there a way to say something meaningful? I like parameters and restrictions too. Like even with drum, I would regularly show up to gigs and I would intentionally leave a piece of the kit at home just to sort of challenge myself. Like, can I still sound good without this cymbal or without this tom? And Instagram, there's only so much space, you know? Yeah. Can I actually say something meaningful in a limited, you know, number of slides? And that challenge has been really difficult for me. And it's all usually pretty raw. It's like, it's either what I'm working on for a future sermon right now, and I'm wanting to see if something makes sense, or it's in response to a sermon, something resonated that I didn't anticipate resonating or something in culture. So it's all pretty real time for me.
Does that translate into your preaching in any way?
You know,
because like they say that brevity is the soul of wit. And I think that economy is the soul of good communication. And those black boxes, they force that upon you. So has that sharpened the way that you think about your preaching moments?
Yep, absolutely. Some of the most frustrating times are when I'm reflecting on a sermon I've already given, trying to think through the format of Instagram, and you end on a distillation that actually is pretty punchy. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I should have done this a week ago. Like that could have worked.
Yeah.
And I think that's happened enough that it's become kind of a part of my my overall prep rhythm now.
Go ahead. Mm-mm. All right. While we're on this, the difference between music and noise is rest. How does that, you said that earlier, how does that translate into your preaching? What does it look like to rest in your preaching, to not be noisy?
Wow.
The difference between a sermon and content is rest.
Yes.
Or so, the difference between a sermon and a harangue.
Yeah.
You know, which is what too many sermons turn into, is just this barrage of moral exhortation or information. But for a sermon to really sing,
yes,
there has to be rest in it.
How does a sermon rest?
What a question. So the first thing that comes to mind for me is I had to kind of come face to face with my own ego and realizing how much I was including in sermons that wasn't helpful but made me look smart. Mm-hmm. having to stare that down was really unnerving. Like, hey, this is just information. And I think it's to make people think that you know Greek better than you do, and it doesn't actually help. And I think there's a lot of insecurity. There's a prayer that I read every Sunday from Every Moment Holy called a Liturgy Before Taking the Stage.
Yeah,
it helps me reframe exactly what you're talking about. But it also helps me recognize, hey, it's often your ego, your need to impress people, your Enneagram 3 that is contributing to a lack of economy of words because you're trying to impress people. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating to me when you look at the arc of Scripture, you know, I don't know what the percentages are, but it's like 70% of it is narrative and 20% is instructive and then genealogies and whatever. And yet our sermon structures tend to look the opposite. It's 90% instructive and then maybe a story to illustrate or to prop up the kind of the moral imperative. And I'm like, man, what if we have more storytelling? Like I read Frederick Buechner's The Sacred Journey, just even how he preaches.
Yes.
I'm like, can we please bring poetry back to the pulpit? Yes. Can we please bring back you maybe like we've even, this is nitpicky, but we no longer call, you know, we used to kind of be a dyed on the wall. Like, what's the application of this? Yeah. I'm like, can we lose application and instead talk about response? Because sometimes the response is just awe.
Yeah.
It's just, Lord, who am I? Son of David, have mercy on me.
Right.
And there actually is no website to go to, and there's no acronym, and I don't have any next steps for you. Yeah. In fact, we're just going to sit in this because God is so holy and so present. And like, to me, those are the moments that when I'm sitting in the chairs that have actually been the most transformative, not the...
That's cool.
Well, that was a killer treatment of that particular verb.
Yeah, right.
I love what you're saying, Ian, when you talk about even the composition of the scriptures, that's an interesting thought. I was thinking about how, the moment you said that, I was thinking about how the middle of our Bible approximately is the Psalms. And so if you have this didactic material and you have a ton of narrative material where there's not a lot of margin, the thing about the Psalms is that they have a lot of white space in them.
So
that's the space where we live in the presence of God, is in white space. I love that, Daniel, you brought up the thing that you said earlier, Ian, about the difference between music and noise is rest. I was also thinking about that. I was kind of stuck on that. And earlier in our conversation with you, when you brought that up, I thought about a documentary that I watched recently on John Batiste, the musician. He was on the Colbert Show for a lot of years and stuff. And he put together, it's the American Symphony is what it's called, and he puts together this huge production. And so the documentary is chronicling putting together this production, but then also his relationship with Suleika. But he has one moment. Have you guys, either of you guys, watched it yet?
I've got it queued up.
Okay, you got to see it. You're both musicians, so you need to watch it as soon as possible. But he's got this one moment in it where he's sitting at the piano with one of his old piano teachers, and he's working through a piece, and his piano teacher has his eyes closed and he's listening to him play. And the teacher says to him, I can tell that you're not playing this right. Or no, he says, I can tell that your breathing is off because of how you're playing this. He could hear his breathing through his playing.
No.
And if that is not a metaphor for the spiritual life, I don't know what is, that we are called first to like get our breathing right with God, to get our rests, our spaces right with God, so that we can be productive in the way that we need to be productive. It's like, and Daniel and I talk about this a lot. It's like, as pastors, like one of our primary jobs is to just get the music of our own lives straight.
That's right.
And how is the music of our congregational life going to be right unless the music of the pastor's life is right? So I have a question that's forthcoming. And the question is, Ian, I mean, you're such a, like, formation is such a huge thing for you. dwelling in the presence of God, living a life of abiding is such a big thing for you. Can you just talk about maybe a handful of the practices that you embrace as a pastor that create rest in your world so that the music of your life does not devolve into noise?
Yeah.
So that you can play the music of your life right. What does that look like for you?
Boy, thanks for sharing all that, man. Yeah, I would first say I'm most certainly a work in progress. And three little kids, those are real reality for me, that I am probably worse at this more days than I'd like to admit. Hudson Taylor once said, don't have your concert first and then tune your instrument.
Yeah.
But to begin your day, you know, I think of like Luther who said, I have so much to do today that I need to spend the first 3 hours of it in prayer.
Yeah.
That is so counterintuitive for me. Mine's more, I have so much to do today, God will understand. Got to get started. So a lot of the practices are actually kind of, they maybe fit the category of micro practices. And they're like, again, annoyingly punchy. But for us as a church, it's like, it's scripture before screens. And that's not prescriptive and it's not how many chapters or for how long or what kind of incense do you burn and what direction do you face? It's like, hey, if this is also, if our phone is a formational device, and I think it is, if it's the first thing we reach for and the last thing we look at, that is forming us whether we're aware of it or not. So how do we, so well, like in line of that, you know, I got little kids. I've created a ritual that when I pull into our driveway, I turn my phone off entirely until my kids go to sleep, which is not honestly that big of a sacrifice. It's about 90 minutes. I do not want my children to hear my voice without seeing the whites of my eyes. Yeah. And there's, I know that like this is a fleeting season. And thankfully, they're still blunt enough that they'll grab me by the cheeks and they'll say, Papa, listen to me. Like they, I know there comes a day that they're going to stop doing that. And they're just going to say, well, whatever he's working on is more important. So I've built in these like really, I know that's like low bar, but I was just getting caught so many times, you know, doom scrolling while also trying to respond to my toddler. And that was, I think, robbing something, not just for me, but from our home. And so like we're in a series right now on the table and how Jesus uses the table and the significance, not just in the first century context, but today. And so that looks like, and instead of the chaotic breakfast at the island, we're going to sit at the table together and we're going to read a story from the Bible. And sometimes it's 2 minutes, sometimes it's longer, you know, but like these very applicable kind of practices and patterns to stand against what is the natural flow of my heart, which is always going more appointments, more things, more accomplishing. How do I disrupt some of that in a way that's meaningful, not just for me, but you know, for my family.
How have your own personal rhythms translated into staff rhythms? Like, does that have any bearing on your leadership of the church?
Yeah. That's tough, man, because I'm not from the Bible Belt, and this church, God bless them, there's a 2-year gap between me and the previous guy. So there was an openness, but also there's a different thing being open to a candidate and then someone who's actually now like in the water implementing things like Sabbath. And, you know, we introduced something we call Blue Sky Days, where 4 times a year, it's a paid work day where you're paid to literally go dream about your life in ministry. And I do not want you on Slack. I don't want you responding to emails. You know, that can feel very counterproductive, to use a crude term. But like, yeah, beginning to introduce some of those things is not always met with cheers either. You know, sometimes it can almost feel lazy to a certain disposition. Why are we emphasizing? You know, I read, who is it? Ruth Haley Barton's Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership. That was one of the first books that I brought our lead team through. And I think she is such a beautiful combination of like, high achieving, get stuff done, and just a deep love for the interior life.
Yeah,
and, it's been helpful for us to kind of have pictures of like, hey, she's not a slouch. Like she's still running and accomplishing, but also has this real like abiding sense of like, hey, apart from the vine, none of this really matters all that much. So learning to find voices like that that we can draw from has been really helpful.
Great,
Ian. I think maybe the final question reading up on you and getting to know more of your story, you've been through church crisis. And so have we. You said that your church was, the attendance had plummeted. You were 6 months from bankruptcy. They're tucked in there. You were very discreet, but you know there's betrayal. You know there's mistrust. You know there's heartache. There's sadness. Yeah. You're receiving the brunt of people's negative energy because the person they trusted messed it up. So yeah. You've been through crisis, and so have we. Can you tell us what you've learned through the process and how you've stayed tender and in love with the church?
Wow. Yeah, when all of that was unraveling at my first church, you know, I'd only been there a year or two, and I was a kid. I didn't know what I was doing objectively. And when we discovered we had 6 months to bankruptcy, it was like the layers just kept getting peeled back. Like there was just so much more than we realized. When the elders had called me in and said, "Hey, do you want to take a crack at it?" My honest response was, "Not really." Like that seems like asking me to captain the Titanic. Like, why would I? And they asked me to pray and fast about it, which was not a discipline that I really had any familiarity with. And I don't know how else to put it, man. The Lord just did a 180 in my heart that I am so grateful for and don't feel like I can take any credit for. I'm sorry. It chokes me up thinking about it, man, because I was dusting off the resume. I was looking to jump ship. And the Lord just did a thing that I was not even looking for. And I remember so desperately wanting to understand what was happening in our church and so desperately aware of my insecurities and how unqualified I was. And, I mean, I was preaching barefoot and I had hair down to here and I didn't know how to lead a staff or balance a butt. I didn't know any of it, man. I loved Jesus and I loved these people so much. So cool. And I remember asking everybody to kind of make sense of the situation. And the narrative of this pastor that was removed was even worse than I realized. And there's the stuff that wasn't hidden. It was like in plain sight. And I remember like really candidly asking, if you knew all of this, like why are you still here? And the response was always, he was such a good preacher. I was willing to put up with everything else. Mm-hmm. Well, Lord save us from that.
Yeah.
You get carte blanche as long as you bring the goods on Sunday. Yeah. And that to me, I think, began to break my heart in a whole different way. Mm-hmm. And I sort of made a commitment, kind of inheriting this legacy of secrecy and deception. I just went the other direction, man. I said, mm-hmm. Everyone sees everything. And I said, we're going to have a once a month congregational meeting. And I will stay here till everyone leaves and I will answer any question you have. And we did that for a year. Mm-hmm. And it was brutal. And in that, the former lead guy sued us, the church. That's a whole other thing. You know, there's trying to navigate all these like very real things. But in that year, I got to hear the actual cries of our community. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you guys understand this. Man, when you go to hell and back with a particular community of people, it changes you. It's like people will say things now like, oh, isn't it a blast to guest speak places? I'm like, I enjoy it. It doesn't hold a candle to walking faithfully with like the
not
same community.
Not even close.
It really isn't. Not and people even. Don't believe me. Mm-hmm. And it's exciting to go to a different place, a different city. And I'm very, very, very grateful for it. Mm-hmm. It's not even in the same stratosphere for me. Right. And mm-hmm. and I'm. It sounds weird to say that I'm grateful for a season that was so devastating and so difficult. And honestly, very... It stirred in me a fear that I didn't even know I had.
Yeah.
But I think it set me on a path that I now, as a 40-year-old, can look over my shoulder and say, Lord, thank you for doing the work in the furnace early, you know. And I think it's contributing to a lot of how I hope to lead now.
It shifted from raw fear to a genuine fear of the Lord. You don't ever want to go there.
Mm.
And so we've been through that. We know that story. And I'll just say to you today, Ian, I love your spirit, man. Mm-hmm. The eyes are the lamp, and I can see a tenderness and a beauty. And 40 years old, 41, 42. So those of you out there who are listening, maybe go buy A Long Obedience in the Same Direction by Eugene Peterson. And Andrew and I say it all the time. He's been saying it for years, and it's now just a refrain, old and holy.
That's the goal.
Mm-hmm. Old and holy. We want to be old and holy. So those of you who are listening, you want to take this the next step, grab that book and make it your prayer to be old and holy. Ian, we bless you today. Yeah. We thank you for your time, and we speak all God's best over the Bridge Church today.
Amen.
Man, thank you, brother. Likewise. Love you guys.